Thank you, Matt, and thank you to those of you joining us again this week. It's good to be here in front of you. As I did last week, I'm going to go ahead and take off the mask because this has a tendency sometimes to muffle the voice. But want to welcome you all to our second virtual press conference here. And as I did last week, I thought it would be helpful just to start with the data and the numbers. I know we get a lot of questions on where we at with the data, where we at with the numbers. So I thought I'd just kick it off by sharing that with you. At this point, we have tested, and this is as of yesterday, but we've tested over 11,000 people. And the positivity rate stays pretty consistent, right around 15%. And so about 15% of those folks have tested positive. And then of those, about 15% have required hospitalization. So we've, at this point, hospitalized a little over 300 patients, of whom about 100, a little more than 100, are still in the hospital today. That means that a lot of people have recovered. They've been discharged from the hospitals. They're fully recovered at home. And so I think that is something important to remember. Remember, of the total population that we have tested, that 11,000, 15% end up testing positive. And of that 15%, really roughly 15% require hospitalization. So we're talking about a pretty small number already. And so we've been able to discharge over 180 patients. We've seen 50 people come out of the ICUs and onto the floors. And we've seen 30 people come off of ventilators. And sometimes these numbers, it's good to remind ourselves that as much as the disease and the virus is very serious, we don't want to downplay that at all. It's a very serious disease. But at the same time, a lot of good things are happening and people are making recoveries and some people never require hospitalization. So we thought that's important to mention. We have had 40 people pass away, die from the COVID virus. Obviously, offer our deepest condolences to the family and friends and neighbors of those folks. But again, also still important to keep in mind that while all of those serious things continue to happen, we see a lot of good reason for celebration as people are making recoveries as well. On the employee front, we've had a little over 100 of our 27,000 employees in Pennsylvania test positive. So that's less than 1%. We have had 4 of our employees hospitalized. Currently none because all 4 were discharged and totally recovered. The other thing that's important to note here is that of those who tested positive who are our employees, the overwhelming majority ended up being community had contracted the virus likely through community contacts. And so I think that's something important to realize. The other thing is that of the employees that meet the criteria that we test, about 8% have tested positive versus for those in the community, about 15% that we test have tested positive. So those are some of the numbers. We know that many of you are paying attention to the national numbers, as are we. There is some evidence, some preliminary sense that there's a flattening of the curve on the national level. I think we have to be a little bit careful of that because so much of the national numbers are driven off of the New York City experience. And as you all know, New York has seen a little bit of a flattening of their curve as they get on the other side of their peak. And so that's driving the same flattening phenomenon that you're seeing on the national level. This is a very local dynamic. And so what we've preferred to do is keep our eyes on that national picture, but also keep a deeper eye on what's going on locally. And so the county by county heat map from the Pennsylvania Commonwealth, that's been where we've been able to see where the case counts are locally. And one thing that we've said last week and still continues to be the case is that the Northeast area, so Luzerne and Lackawanna counties, is where we have observed the deepest most substantial climb in the degree of cases. Although even there, I think it's worth noting that over the last week, we've seen the early evidence that suggests that there may be some flattening. And so that's very reassuring. I think it's also, though, still important to make sure we keep our foot on the gas. We are not at all out of the woods. We know that even as the Northeast may start to plateau and flatten, we fully expect, and our data predictive models suggest, that all the other areas that we serve, all the other counties that we serve, will still see their own version of the peak. It is a little bit flatter and a little bit farther out than what we had originally envisioned, but this will be with us well into June, July, and perhaps even into August, depending on the area that you're talking about. And what we have seen is that as the Northeast starts to flatten and plateau, the other areas will in a staggered way follow closely behind it by 2 to 3 weeks, 3 to 4 weeks at a time. And so we'll see this wave progress to other regions throughout our service area. I think the other message that we've been really emphasizing as we've been out into the communities and also talking to our workforce is that this is not the time to ease up. I think the distancing efforts, the precautions that we've all been taking within our communities have been paying off. That's the good news. So we see flatter curve projections and so forth, as I mentioned. But if there's ever a time to be even more careful, it's now, because as we see talk of opening up segments of society, I think that's exactly when we got to be super careful. We believe there is a way to open up and phase segments of society back in, as long as we're still keeping distancing efforts and precautionary measures in place to ensure that we're all being careful, whether it's masking, hand hygiene, distancing, all of those things. So shifting gears from the numbers, I want to take a moment, as I did last week, to just thank every one of our staff. I mean, this has been a tremendous time where people have risen to the occasion, as you can imagine, quite a disruptive time, where people have had new roles or reassignments into new areas that they're not used to. Sometimes that's involved picking up skills that they had once before and sort of getting back on the bike. Other times it's actually been training and receiving familiarity and training in new areas that they've never touched before. And so in order to do that, it requires people to be adaptable, people to be willing to adapt to change and be flexible. And our workforce has done exactly that. They've been tremendously innovative and creative in terms of problem solving. I could go through many examples of that because I've had the blessing and luxury of being able to get out and about and round, so to speak, in our various areas and campuses. And we have people who have been creative around how they're donning and doffing the gear, how they're using extensions to manage IVs and ventilators, even how they're able to wear their mask by looping behind buns of hair as opposed to the ears so that they get a nice tight seal with the mask. I mean, there's a lot of creativity and ingenuity, and we are deeply appreciative of that. I think the other note worth mentioning here is that we are also deeply appreciative and thankful for all of what the community has done. I think the resounding show of support, whether it's signs or cards or people writing things on the sidewalk, words of encouragement, these things actually do matter. And they matter a lot to our workforce as they're coming in. And it's a tremendously encouraging and uplifting moment. And we want to thank our communities for doing that. They've also stepped up as far as donations, both big and small, whether it's in-kind equipment or supplies or even monetary. Of course, we're extremely grateful for all of that. I want to remind everybody of the five same things that we said last week. Please stay home as much as possible. Please wash your hands as much as possible. Please try not to touch your face as much as possible. Keep the surfaces clean. And lastly, give back and lend a hand to your friends and neighbors and families. So that's the facts that we have prepared and the data. I think I'm gonna shift gears, maybe turn it back over to you, Matt. I think there were some submitted questions in advance, right?
First question we have is from WKOK Radio, North Central PA, and others, and it's about the topic of antibody testing, with the state of New York, Pennsylvania Department of Health, Red Cross, and others announcing exploring COVID-19 antibody testing? Is Geisinger pursuing this type of testing as well?
Yeah, so this has been a question that's really picked up in steam. I think this past week we've gotten a lot of inbound questions around antibody testing. Few comments I would make on this. One is it's an emerging technology. I think this is one where the testing is still, from an accuracy standpoint, not quite where we would want it to be, at least in terms of what's commercially available. And we're actively exploring and assessing three different commercially available testing options as far as antibody testing. But at this stage, we believe the technology is still not at the right levels of accuracy to put it into real life scenarios. The other thing that's important is I think some people confuse the antibody testing because it's really used for two different purposes. One is for diagnostic purposes, and that's where the current lab testing that we have is a lot more accurate. And so I don't see us moving away from that for the purposes of diagnosing somebody with whether or not they have the virus. But the second use case for antibody testing is to track the disease. And so the public health folks call this disease surveillance, and it allows you to look at a population or a community and look to see how many of those folks may have already been exposed to the disease. And if you're doing that over time, you could trend whether that disease is waxing or waning in intensity. That's what a lot of the public health systems that you're reading about, that is the use case that they're using this testing for. Along those lines, it's also used to figure out if someone has recovered from the disease, to see if you could have donated plasma, because the belief is that the plasma from folks who have already recovered may confer some therapeutic benefit to those who actively have the disease. And so there are a variety of different use cases, but I think the punchline here is that the accuracy isn't at the same levels as the current diagnostic test. And so we think for diagnosis purposes, it makes sense to continue the course there. But from a disease surveillance standpoint, we're absolutely intrigued. And that's why we're assessing the three different commercially available options. And hopefully in the weeks to come, we'll be incorporating that into our testing portfolio. At the same time, just there may be a question later about the convalescent serum infusion. So the serum from folks who have recovered from the virus, we started doing our first handful of infusions along those lines. Right now, the limitation is getting the donors from folks who have recovered. And so we're trying to build that program as well.
Next question is from the Press Enterprise. Following the announcement of the Emergency Assistance Fund for employees, how does that fund work? Who would qualify, and how much money are employees eligible for?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that probably all of us are aware of is that COVID is not just a public health issue and a clinical issue. It is wide-reaching in its impact across all segments of society, and that includes the financial impact to all of us, not just those of us in healthcare, but really the communities around us. The Employee Assistance Fund that you referenced, Matt, was put in place, started through contributions from both the executive team, but also other employees that stepped up wanting to create a fund. And so we did just that. And it's really intended for any of our employees whose households have seen any kind of hardship as a result of COVID. The folks who are not eligible are the folks deemed to be highly compensated individuals per the IRS guidelines. Those folks are not eligible, but for everybody else, they're eligible to apply for up to $1,000. And that's how we're starting the program. But the idea is if they have rent payments or food payments, transportation payments, you name it, if they're facing a hardship through that application process, their cases can be evaluated, and we're trying to help as many people as possible through that fund.
Also from the Press Enterprise, has Geisinger Health System received any coronavirus-related financial assistance from the federal government? If so, how much?
Yeah, so I think just along the same theme of the finances, I don't know if we've shared with this group yet, but early on, probably about a month ago, and this has now been going on for about 6 weeks as far as the lockdown, but about a month ago, we did our early estimates of what would the financial impact be to Geisinger. And the estimate that we came up with was that typically we would see a negative $100 million impact on a monthly basis as a result of COVID. Believe it or not, we've had many weeks of experience at this point, and we're seeing it roughly track to that number. And so the impact is pretty significant. The good news here is that there is some support. Many folks have pointed to the CARES Act or the stimulus package passed by Congress a few weeks back. And we have received $53 million thus far, of which $40 million or so is allocated to our Pennsylvania operation. But as you can tell by the numbers, that's that defrays some, but certainly not all of that monthly $100 million negative impact number. And so we do anticipate and hope that we'll continue to see a little bit of that constant assistance. But at the same time, we know based on our experience thus far and based on what's been passed so far, it will not defray anywhere near the total impact that we're facing as a result of COVID. That being said, I think you know, our elected officials and the folks in Harrisburg and Washington, D.C., we're extremely grateful. We continue to partner with them. I think they're doing everything they can, and we can't tell you how thankful we are for the help that we have. But in answer to the question, it defrays only some, and we still face a significant negative impact.
Next question, again, Press Enterprise and several others as well. Has Geisinger furloughed any employees during the coronavirus pandemic?
So the approach that we've taken around our employees, a couple things. One, early on, we went out and said that we're going to keep our employees whole from a salary continuation standpoint through April 25th, and we've done that. We are coming up on that date, as you know. And so the next chapter of what our approach will be is something that we just started communicating this week. But I think the plan A, or the preferred course, and this is what we try to do at every turn, is to find areas where we can reassign folks from areas that don't have as much activity to areas that have a lot more activity. And I'll give you some examples. As folks know, we canceled elective non-urgent OR procedures, as did most health systems, actually all health systems throughout the state. So those areas have a lot less activity going on. But areas like the ICU, or areas like employee health, or areas like our hotline call center, those areas have seen more activity than they've ever seen in the past. And so being able to reassign our staff from this, the first kind of area to the second kind of area, that's been a key part of our formula, and that's going to be our prioritized approach going forward. Now, there will be some folks who aren't able to be reassigned, either because the matching just doesn't quite fit or their skill set doesn't match up. And for those folks, we've created a host of options that they could draw from, whether it's their banked PTO time or vacation time or donated PTO time, because a lot of our employees are coming forth and actually donating their unused PTO, or even borrowing against their future vacation or PTO time. Those are just some examples of the different options that they have before they would ever need to get to an unpaid leave scenario.
Next question is from the Scranton Times, WNEP, and others. You alluded to it earlier, but what is Geisinger's take on reopening the economy?
You know, it's one of these things where it's looking more and more, and we've used this term, it is a marathon. It's not a sprint. I mean, COVID is going to be with us for quite some time. In fact, we've even revisited the term the road to recovery, because it looks like for a while we will have COVID with us. And so then the challenge becomes figuring out how to manage in a practical way so that you're still being mindful of all the precautions you need to take because the virus is still there, but being able to be really targeted and focused and thoughtful about reopening segments of society. And so I think it can be done. I like the fact that if you're identifying certain functions versus other functions, it feels like that's a better way to approach it and to approach it in phases. I think these are all things that jive and resonate with us. The other thing that we've observed and that I think is true is this doesn't flip on like a switch. This is more like a dimmer where it doesn't, the activity doesn't shut down all at once. And even as we get back in, I don't think it picks up all at once. So it's going to be gradual, which is a good thing because it allows us to be really thoughtful about how to make sure that precautions are still there. And so as businesses reopen, as manufacturing shops reopen, as other businesses start to reopen, I think it's going to be important for folks to keep those things in mind. You may see operations that look very different. For example, people should be staggered and separated by 6 feet. And I think that'll make a lot of environments look different than what we were used to prior to COVID. And depending on your work environment, it may mean that lunch breaks get staggered. It may mean every hour people take a break to wash hands. It may mean that shifts are staggered so that you don't have as many people in the building at a given time. I think we're going to see all of those kinds of ingredients in this solution.
Next question, somewhat related from the Williamsport Sun Gazette. Is there a timeline as to when all surgical procedures will be up and running again at Geisinger?
Yeah, so there's a lot of discussion around when will we start doing surgeries again. And we are, I mean, we're still keeping close tabs on our patients, and we've been able to ramp up telemedicine quite a bit to the extent that now we're doing thousands of telemedicine visits every day. And in those visits, I know that our physicians and our providers hear about the care needs that are still there that we've had to postpone for a while. So we're as eager as anybody else to reinstate and reincorporate the elective procedures into what we do. We have a team that's been working on that plan of how we do it, because this too, we think, is something that needs to be phased over time. Probably categories of cases and types of procedures that would go first, and then other categories that would go later. Because at the end of the day, we're balancing the clinical needs, but also the realities of some of these cases will need beds. Some of these cases will need ventilators or ICUs or blood. And we want to make sure we're taking all of those things into account. The other dynamic is the role of testing in all of this. As you all know, we're one of the three sites across the entire state of Pennsylvania as far as systems that have the capability of doing their own on-site testing. It's been a huge privilege to be able to do that, and we think that positions us well to really explore what role testing has in terms of people who come in for these procedures. But we're exploring all of those things right now with our team of experts. Now, in the coming weeks would be my guess that we're probably going to reincorporate elements of the procedures that we had previously canceled or rescheduled. And over time, gradually, you'll see more and more of those cases get reinstated.
So we had a question come in from Sarah at the Lewistown Sentinel, speaking towards modeling and the predictions around the virus, of asking, how are we able to know if this will end by July or August? And how is this different from other coronaviruses that have been around for years?
So I would say it won't end by July or August, because when we talk about the July or August timeframe, we mean the peak. And as we've said, you gradually get to the peak, but then you gradually come down from the peak. And so if the peak is July or August, it may still mean that you're having cases well into the fall. And so I think that's important to remember, regardless of what the timing of the peak is, regardless of the individual geography that you're in, you don't go to the peak and then it goes to zero. You kind of gradually come back down. But I think the other element to the question is, how do we model these things? And there are a lot of smart people across the country that have been looking at this. And it's from places like Johns Hopkins or UPenn or from University of Washington or Carnegie Mellon. And there are many data models that are out there, and there are a lot of inputs. They input how many people are being tested that meet criteria, how many people are actually testing positive, how frequently does the case count double, how many people are getting admitted, how many people are dying. And I'm probably just rattling off a smidgen of all the different data inputs. But all those things go into a predictive algorithm, and they project when they think that that case count is going to hit that peak and then start coming back down. And so that's what our internal data folks have also employed. We have our own algorithm that incorporates many of those different ones that I described. And based on that, that's where our projections come from. And at the same time that we do that, we keep our eyes on the projections that others are doing in the marketplace as well, comparing notes to make sure that we're looking at it the same way. And I think that's the consensus that's emerging, is that the Northeast, we know that that peak will hit sooner. And then in the other areas, we know that those waves will come 3 or 4 weeks later, and then 3 or 4 weeks after that, and 3 or 4 weeks after that. And for the Lewistown Center, Mifflin County area, that puts us well into July. So the other caveat, though, is much like predicting the weather, it's not 100% science. And so that is important to remember, that as behavior changes, as different functions of society reopen, it could be that we see spikes in the case counts if we're not being cautious and taking the right precautions as a society.
I think we may have time for one more question here from WBRE. How is staff holding up, and are there any special provisions to keep them comfortable?
I can't tell you how proud I am, you know, and thankful for the staff that we have, because these are trying times, as we all know. And it's not just trying times in the workplace, but even in the home environment, everybody's lives have been disrupted. And to still be able to rise to the occasion and meet the challenge of this, it's just, it's inspiring, it's encouraging, and our staff have responded well. That being said, we know it's difficult. And so we've set up a variety of things as an employer. They have a very easy access to, just by texting, to some counseling services. We've set up respite rooms. We've set up childcare on site at many of our campuses. We set up this employee assistance fund. We also have a 24/7 hotline to get them information should they need it. We could set them up with counseling support even otherwise. There's just been a lot of efforts. The team has really come together. And I think all of these things, any individual one, I don't think it's a silver bullet that solves everything. But taken in the aggregate, I think people feel like they're generally supported, that we're being really transparent with the information. I think sometimes the most challenging part is uncertainty. And however much information we have, we're just sharing it because we think it's important for folks to know. And I think it helps them ease their anxiety and stress. And so any area where we could take some of the stress burden away, whether it's work-related or personal-related, that's the approach we've taken. And so far, you know, we've been okay.
Question we've got from WKOK and the Citizen's Voice. There's talk of COVID-19 making a comeback in the fall and coinciding with flu season. Do you think that we are prepared for this to happen, and will we be back in a stay-at-home situation come the fall?
I think it's too early to tell, but I think this is another one where we've tried to be really careful with the words, because we don't think COVID will ever disappear. It kind of gets to the earlier comment about you hit a peak and it doesn't just drop off and go to zero. You still have these cases as you're coming down from that peak, and there's a really real possibility that it's just going to persist in some way until we have a meaningful vaccine, which could be a year from now. And so for that next flu season, it's very likely that we'll have both COVID and the regular flu rearing its head as it always does in the fall. I think this is even more reason where people have to get those flu shots, because what we do know is when you have COVID and regular flu, your outcomes are substantially worse. And so if you could at least get the flu shot and prevent the flu, or have less of a chance that you'll get the flu, and still try to prevent COVID, but God forbid, you let's say you get COVID, that's still better than if you got hit with the 1-2 punch. And so I think those are going to be some of the themes that we get out into the community with as we approach flu season. We were pretty aggressive this year in terms of trying to get everybody vaccinated for the flu. We're going to be even more aggressive next year because it's going to make a difference, especially in the context of still having COVID in the picture.